Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, Brown University public policy professor and political scientist Marion Orr talks about his latest book, House of Diggs, The Rise and Fall of America's Most Consequential Black Congressman, Charles C. Diggs, Jr. It was published by the University of North Carolina Press in September of this year. An award-winning author, Marion Orr was interviewed via Zoom by fellow biographer and BIO member Eric K. Washington.
Marion Orr, well, first, double congratulations, because in 2022, you were the second winner of BIO's Francis Frank Rolland Fellowship, our annual award for biography and progress on an African-American figure. And this was the book that you were working on when you won. And now this book is an actual wonderful, edifying book. So double congratulations.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you and the Rollins Committee and BIO for awarding me. I was really excited and really pleased to win that award. And I'm so happy to be a part of BIO. And
Well, we were excited to give you the award, and we're excited to have the book, you know, in our paws.
Yes.
So who was Charles C. Diggs, Jr., and what made him so consequential?
Well, when we think of Black leadership in Congress after the Second World War, Adam Clayton Powell comes to mind. If you move into the 60s, people may mention Shirley Chisholm or Barbara Jordan. These are names that are familiar. Charles Diggs, Jr., was a Congress member from Detroit. He was elected in 1954, and he served in Congress until 1980. And he was a remarkable American leader who left an imprint and a legacy on two continents. He was a freedom fighter for civil rights here in the U.S. and North America, and he was a freedom fighter for Black Africans in Africa, on the continent there, especially in Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. So he really left a tremendous legacy. He was a quiet, somewhat unassuming, hardworking legislator that I think oftentimes his contributions perhaps got overshadowed by the looming presence of Adam Clayton Powell. Mm-hmm. But Diggs was a remarkable leader, as I tried to lay out in the book.
What drew you to write about him?
Well, I learned about Congressman Diggs many, many years ago when I was an undergraduate student at Savannah State College down in my hometown of Savannah, Georgia. I majored in political science as an undergraduate, and I was taught at Savannah State by the country's leading political science expert on Black American politics. His name was Haynes Walton, Jr. Professor Walton taught at Savannah State for 25 years, and Professor Walton taught many of the classes at Savannah State in political science, and Diggs came up often in many of the courses that Professor Walton taught. And so I knew about Diggs since I was about 18 years old. And then when I went off to graduate school to do a PhD in political science, I learned still more about Congressman Diggs. And so he's been on my mind for a very, very long time. When I discovered that there was no biography of the congressman, I decided to take the plunge and to write what is now the first biography of him.
Now, apparently, the House of Diggs, of the title, was a well-known and revered Detroit institution. Talk about its proprietor, Charles C. Diggs Sr., who, as you explained in the book, was a respected politician in his own right.
Yes, Congressman Diggs' father, Charles Diggs Sr., and his mother, Mamie Diggs, they were Southerners who moved to Detroit from the South. The father was from Mississippi, and the mother was originally from Tennessee. And they were part of the Great Black Migration. They arrived in Detroit around 1913 or so, And they would eventually, the mother and father, would form a funeral home in Detroit. It started in 1922 and it would really take off in the 1940s. The funeral home became known as the House of Dix. And by the 1940s and 1950s, the House of Dix funeral home was the dominant funeral home in Detroit for Black Americans. And so the Dix family buried about half of the Black folk who died in Detroit in the 40s, 50s, and 1960s. The father, Charles Dix Sr., would parlay the success of the funeral home into electoral politics. In 1936, Charles Dix Sr. would win election as the first Black Democrat to the Michigan legislature in 1936. He was a pioneering business person and a pioneering civic and political leader in Detroit and Michigan for about 30 years, beginning in the 30s until his death in 1967. He was a phenomenal person and had a big, big impact on his only child, Charles Diggs Jr.
Well, you speak of the practical logic of Diggs Jr.'s politics of strategic moderation as a driving tenet of his career. Was this a departure from his father's style of politics?
It was probably an extension of the father's politics. Charles Dix Sr. was an early supporter in the Black community of the growing industrial labor movement in Detroit in the 1930s. Many Blacks in the 20s and 30s had real reservations about the labor union movement and were hesitant to be part of the industrial labor unions. But Charles Dix Sr. early on played a big role in bringing Blacks in Detroit, many of whom worked for the auto industry, bringing them into alliance with the growing labor movement. Charles Dix Sr. understood the growing power of unionism in Detroit, and so the father would play a key part in forging a coalition of liberal whites, the labor union movement, and Black Americans will form an alliance in the 1940s that would be present until the late 1960s. And so this sort of biracial labor coalition is something that Dix Jr. watched develop as a young teenager and early 20-year-old person. The son watched and learned from the father how Blacks and white working class people can forge and develop political power together. And so when Diggs goes to Washington as a Congress member, he is attuned to the whole idea of coalition building and how critical and important it is in politics.
So tell us a little more about the politics of strategic moderation that you speak
yes.
of.
Well, what I lay out early on in the book, Eric, is that when you look at Congressman Diggs' politics, especially in comparison to the other two Blacks who were in Congress at the time, because when Diggs goes to Congress in 1955, there are only two other Blacks in Congress, Adam Clayton Powell, who took a very militant, radical approach to racial politics. He was from Harlem, from New York City. And then you had Congressman William Dawson from Chicago. Dawson was very conservative on racial matters and was very reluctant to speak out on issues of discrimination and race, largely because he was so tied to and controlled by the Chicago political machine. Diggs comes into office and his approach is somewhat different. Diggs is convinced that in the 50s and 60s, Black folk who are a racial minority and a numerical minority had to have the support of the broadest spectrum as possible. And so when I say Diggs practiced the politics of strategic moderation, I'm not saying he was a moderate in the sense of the way we use it today. Today, politicians say they are moderates in order to distinguish themselves from the extreme wings of their party. That's not what I'm saying about Congressman Diggs. I'm saying Congressman Diggs was a moderate in that his approach was to build coalitions of conservatives, of radicals, of moderates, all in a pragmatic and rational approach to getting things done for Black Americans, who again were a racial minority and a numerical minority. So he was a moderate in terms of his approach. Let me emphasize this, Eric. Diggs was, to his heart, a race man. He fought strongly and forcefully for Black Americans and for Black Africans. So he was, without question, a race man. But he had this approach in terms of trying to get things done through Congress. The Founding Fathers established the Congress to be an institution of bargaining and compromise. And Diggs tried to do just that as a member of Congress for some almost 25 years.
So Diggs was a freshman in Congress when one of the most horrific and iconic episodes of the civil rights era occurs, the racist murder in Mississippi of Emmett Till, a Black 14-year-old. Diggs was the only federal official who attended the trial, you wrote, of the boys' killers, who a local all-white jury ultimately acquitted. How did that experience shape the role that Diggs assumed as a public figure?
Well, the experience that Diggs had those 5 days that he spent in Mississippi, he was there to observe the trial of these two white men who later admitted to killing the young Emmett Till. Diggs was there, and his presence was very, very significant. It really, really helped in a number of ways. One, the Black witnesses who were really frightened to come forth later said that having Diggs, a powerful Black man from the federal government in the courtroom, gave them the courage to come forth and to testify about what they witnessed, the killing of Emmett Till. They identified the two white men. The other thing that's significant about Diggs' presence there, Eric, is that because, as you indicated, he was a new Black member of Congress going down to Mississippi in this racially tense trial in the small town, his presence brought additional media attention to what was happening at the trial, and moreover, broader issues of civil rights in the South. And what Diggs was saying when he went down to Mississippi, he was very, very strategic in this. He was sending a signal that although he was from Detroit, he was going to be a congressman for all of Black America. And that's the kind of congressman he would continue to be.
And did that episode, that experience of that episode, was that what introduced him to Martin Luther King?
As you know, shortly after the killing and then the trial, Black people in Montgomery, Alabama began this boycott. And one of the people who led the boycott was a young preacher named Martin Luther King Jr. Diggs did not know Dr. King until the boycott. Diggs reached out to Dr. King at the beginning of the boycott. And the congressman was the host of the House of Diggs Funeral Home weekly radio program. And during the broadcast, he raised $10,000 in Detroit for Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott. And he raised the money, and I believe in April of 1956, he went down and met Dr. King for the first time and gave Dr. King the money that was raised by the folk in Detroit. And that was the beginning of a close friendship between Martin Luther King Jr., the son of a preacher, and Charles Diggs, the son of a funeral director. And they became partners in the struggle for civil rights in the U.S.
And $10,000, that's then money, not now money. So,
yes, that's a lot, was a lot of money. And so it was the beginning of a long friendship that would end, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated in 1968. But
Wow.
there are letters in the archives. They greet each other in their letters by their first name.
Well, that's great.
An indication, I think, of the closeness of the two men.
Exactly, yeah. So you started off, you write about how we went on to tackle desegregation of the airline terminals, founded the Congressional Black Caucus, which we all still know of today, and was a chief architect of legislation that restored home rule to Washington, D.C., which I think a lot of Americans don't know about that because we're all from states.
Yeah, D.C. is a unique political entity.
And that was a big deal at the time.
Yes.
And as Mr. Africa, as you say, he was called, Diggs almost single-handedly ignited the U.S.'s anti-apartheid movement in the 1960s.
Well, you touched on some of the important tangible legacies of this consequential Congress member. Most people didn't realize that there was segregation also going on in the airline industry, in particular in the southern airport terminals, where segregation took place on a daily basis. And what I write about in the book is how Diggs used his oversight authority. And he knew there was something called oversight that the Congress had over the executive branch. And he would use that oversight authority to force federal regulators to desegregate the southern airport terminals before the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Wow. It's interesting to think about the absurdity, because I guess you could be flying in an integrated plane, white and black sitting next to one another, but then when you land, then you might be forced to go your separate ways in the terminal.
Yes, and this was the case in many, many airports throughout the South, and in some cases in other parts, but largely in the South. And Diggs understood, for example, that the federal government funded the building of many of these airport terminals. And many of the grants that these southern states and cities obtained from the federal governments to help build the airports had provisions in them that prohibited discrimination. They were violating federal regulation, but the regulators were not enforcing it until Diggs used his oversight authority and brought it to the attention of the federal regulators. This is why it's so important that representation of our community, Black communities, are so important, because these are the kind of issues that we see historically and even today that Black members of Congress will take on in their oversight authority. Diggs also, as you mentioned, Eric, was the person who restored home rule to Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is the federal seat of government. It was carved out and formed from parts of Virginia and parts of Maryland. The founding fathers thought it wisely not to have the federal government in a particular state, in Pennsylvania or New York or Georgia. They said, well, let's have a special district. They carved out a district from Maryland and from Virginia. And the Constitution gives Congress exclusive authority over that federal district. And so before the Civil War and before Reconstruction, Congress allowed local voters to elect local officials in the district. Congress allowed that. After the Civil War, after more Black people moved to the district, after Reconstruction, Congress changed that. And they allowed the mayor and city council members to now be appointed officials. Many people don't know this, Eric, but for many years, the president of the United States appointed the mayor of Washington, D.C. It was not until 1973 that Diggs, and I underscore this, restored home rule to Washington, D.C. And home rule was taken away, and it was not given until 1973 because white folk in Congress and white people in Washington, D.C. did not want Black people to run and govern the district. But by 1957, the district was a majority Black city.
So I
and
want
let me say, you mentioned the Congressional Black Caucus. He was the founder of the Congressional Black Caucus. They often talk about 13 founding members. Well, there were 13 founding members, but the archives and the records make it very clear. Diggs brought those members together. And then I could say, finally, you mentioned Mr. Africa.
Right.
If I was pressed about his greatest accomplishment, I would have to say it had to be Southern Africa. It was his greatest challenge and his greatest accomplishment. Diggs was talking about apartheid in South Africa in the 1950s and in the 1960s, before many Americans knew what apartheid was, that system whereby the white minority controlled South Africa public policy, you see. And so Diggs would use his position on the House Foreign Affairs Committee to awaken America to this racist system of apartheid and to raise the question of why is it that our country, claimed to be a democracy, will be aligned with this racist regime that subjugated its black majority under the system of apartheid. And Diggs would work really hard to address this issue. And as you know, in 1994, I believe, Nelson Mandela became the first black president of South Africa. It was the first time that black South Africans got a chance to vote in national elections. So the American anti-apartheid movement in this country literally started in Congressman Diggs' congressional office.
Wow. With all of these disparate facets of his life and career, you must have had a whole array of archives and sources that you relied upon or that you tapped into. Can you talk a little bit about what were some of those sources that you accessed?
I was really lucky that there are lots of sources that this project built on. The main source, the papers of Congressman Diggs, papers himself. The congressman left his congressional and personal and business papers to Howard University. Some 750 boxes of material, constituent letters, and letters concerning the business, the House of Diggs, all there. So the Diggs papers archive at Howard University is really the key data source. But I also access documents at the archives of all the presidents that Diggs served under. He served under six presidents. Diggs was a prolific writer of letters, memoranda, and telegrams to U.S. presidents, secretaries of cabinets, and agency heads. And so when you go to the Eisenhower or the Johnson or the Nixon library, you find lots of documents. And then let me add, finally, I interviewed family members, I interviewed friends, I interviewed staff members, and I interviewed several former members of Congress who served with Charlie Diggs, people like Charlie Rangel, the congressman from New York. I interviewed Ronald Dellums, the congressman from Berkeley, California. William Bill Clay from St. Louis, who was around when the Congressional Black Caucus was formed. So I got a chance to talk to people who knew the congressman, his family members, his children, his ex-wife, and folk who worked with him on Capitol Hill to help me paint a fuller portrait of this remarkable American.
That's great. Yeah, and given, you know, the exhaustive scholarly research that you brought to the book, how did you approach writing it for a broader readership?
Well, that was my goal from the very beginning. This is my eighth book, but this is my first attempt to reach a broad audience. And let me just say this. The character of Congressman Diggs, his life story is a fascinating story that lends itself to the kind of scenes and experiences that can draw a reader in. So, for example, I had a wonderful time, and I think my favorite chapters in writing the book was probably the two chapters on his a venture into Mississippi and the Emmett Till trial. Wonderful scenes that one can lean on and write. So it's in part just the interesting, fascinating life of this man who, you know, had a wonderful, interesting experience of life that I'm able to sort of put on paper and to share.
Yeah, many of the scenes are like really vividly cinematic and really, really engaging in that way. One of the things that's really impressive is that, you know, you give Diggs his props, but you don't pull punches either. The book title says The Rise and Fall of the Congressman. So tell us about the fall.
Yeah, he had a tragic fall. Congressman Diggs could never seemingly manage his personal expenses. For example, at one point when he was working for his father at the funeral home as a young man, he would run out of money and go to his father and ask for more money. And his father would say, "Son, you have a salary. You know, you need to live within your means." But the congressman would only go to his mother. His mother would give him the money that his father would not give him. So he had a challenging time managing his personal finances. The congressman was married four times. He had six children. And so Diggs, the congressman, especially after his father got older and eventually killed himself, he would go to the funeral home and ask for money to help for his expenses. And the funeral home eventually would collapse, and he no longer had access to this kind of money to help in his personal expenses. And then the way I explain it is, Diggs became really desperate for money. And in this desperation, he engaged in an illegal payroll kickback scheme with his employees in Congress. So for example, his secretary, he gave his secretary a significant salary increase, but the salary increase came back to the congressman to help pay his personal bills. And in 1977, someone called the Justice Department and told the Justice Department that Diggs had been engaged in this payroll kickback scheme. And that tip led to a Justice Department investigation into Diggs. And he was indicted, and he would eventually be convicted of all 29 charges that the government brought against him. Of course, he had to resign his seat because of this. He was also censored by the House. Censure is the strongest punishment that the House can render. In fact, Diggs was the first Congress member to be censored when he was censored in 1978, the first one in some 60 years.
Well,
my book reveals for the first time this anonymous caller who told what
wait.
Diggs was doing. And I'm not going to reveal that now.
Okay, I was going to stop you.
It's in the book, and encourage the listeners of the podcast to take a look at it. In addition to the other data, the archives and interviews, I got a hold of Diggs' FBI file, and this helped me identify the anonymous tipster.
Right. The marvelous, marvelous book. It's still sticking with me, so many parts of it. And I congratulate you again.
Oh, thank you, Eric.
And with what advice would you give to first-time biographers, particularly those working on a project of similar scope and complexity?
I would encourage patience. To write a biography on a substantial figure takes real time. And it took me 10 years of research and writing. I did not think it would take that long, but it did. So I would tell anyone who's doing this for the first time to be patient. The other thing I would say is try to pick someone that I think that you can really enjoy and find interesting. You don't have to like the person per se, but maybe if he or she has an interesting life, that's something that can pull you into the writing, because writing can be a lonely enterprise. So if you have something that have you engaged, I think that's very, very important. And Eric, the other advice I would give, and I say this in all honesty, anybody who wants to write a biography should become a member of Biographers International Organization. When I started writing the book, A woman named Dr. Ida Jones was an archivist at Howard University. She's now the chief archivist at Morgan State University in Baltimore. And Dr. Jones wrote a biography. And when I went to the Diggs papers at Howard, she said, I encourage you to reach out and join bio. And I
Oh,
did.
you
And
thank Ida Jones then.
Everybody, you know, interested in biography, and they know what each other's going through. They're very helpful. And so I would tell anyone who want to do this, you want to be involved in bio. It could really help you and sustain you in the process of writing.
Well, thank you. Thank Ida Jones for steering you to bio.
Oh, yes. I
Thank
really
you
appreciate
for
her.
Pitching your submission to the Rollin Fellowship.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Thank you for having me on the podcast. And thank you again to the Bio organization for supporting my work.
That was Brown University professor and author Marion Orr, speaking with bio member Eric K. Washington about his biography, House of Diggs, The Rise and Fall of America's Most Consequential Black Congressman, Charles C. Diggs, Jr. It was published by the University of North Carolina Press in September 2025, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in November of this year. To learn more about bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.